Gaming Discourse. I'm Tyler Frater, alongside Richard Day the Cruz.
Hello.
And Chief Engineer Lieutenant Commander Connor Frater.
Good evening.
It is Monday, May 6th, 2024. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Gaming Discourse. Don't follow us on Twitter. Just go to our YouTube channel, YouTube/Gaming Discourse. That's where you should go. Don't go to social
media. Those are where the tweets are.
That's where the content is. New content this week. I talked with Dr. Tanya Pettiford-Waits, who is the professor of pedagogy, acting and directing at VCU, and she played Echo 419, Foehammer, in Halo Combat Evolved. So I talked with her. I talked with her about her experience acting. I talked with her about, she had a small role in Twin Peaks, so she talked a little about her experience with David Lynch. She was actually directed by David Lynch. And then, yeah, I talked about what she remembered from her time recording her parts for the original Halo. So, Richard, it's okay. You can open that.
No, it's already open, right. But yeah, I forgot that, like, when it's still full, you will get the still, so I didn't want to, like,
You didn't want to harsh my groove there. It's fine. No. But yeah, so go check that out. I think it was a good discussion. There's a few other interviews I want to try getting, but I'm not somebody that can just talk. I have to, like, do background to understand somebody, mm-hmm. so I can kind of figure out, like, what better questions to ask.
That's very important, getting some good questions. I mean, obviously, it's interview, I mean, like, there's a lot of interviews that are the same questions over and over, and it's so much better when you have very unique questions that gets the interviewee excited.
And that takes lots of research. It takes looking through past interviews and stuff like that. So
mm-hmm. Tyler's going to be the next Nardwar for video games.
I think he's Kendrick's informant.
So are we team Kendrick here? Are we team
So
Kendrick?
I've always held the position that I don't like Drake's music.
Okay.
It's always been, I just don't like his voice.
About this beef. I know nothing about beefs in general. The only beef I know of is usually going on a
USDA.
USDA certified beef going between two perfectly crusted pieces of bread.
This is definitely certified beef.
So maybe, I don't know, if this is certified beef, maybe I should look into it. I don't know. Toss it on the grill.
I mean, it's
a little pink inside.
It's worth, you know, listening to a couple of those mm-hmm. who are, like, who can explain it in detail very well.
Yeah. Sure. So. Yeah. And I don't know. It feels like they're, because we were, I don't know why we're talking about this. We'll put time codes. Skip if you want to hear about video games. We'll talk in a second. But it feels like there's some, because beef is sort of a, what's the word I'm looking for? It sounds juvenile, beef, right?
Oh, okay. Yes.
But
yes.
It seems like there are some legitimate, like,
grievances,
like, artistic mm-hmm. critiques yes. here about, yeah. like, different stuff, which I, again, know nothing about, but I think that's actually interesting, because I don't know how many times artists will, like, go after one another. Like, how many times Steven Spielberg isn't out there going, hey, you know, fucking fuck other directors. I couldn't think of another director. Fuck David Lynch. Like, Steven Spielberg isn't. He's not making movies where the entire movie is about David Lynch being a bitch or something like that. Mm-hmm. But singers do it all the time, and it's interesting, yeah.
So a lot of hip-hop culture also views hip hop as a music form and as a sport.
Interesting.
For the lyricism, remarks you can make, music, double entendre, triple entendre, stuff mm-hmm. like that. And so it starts out like that. But Kendrick apparently hates Drake.
Interesting.
And I don't feel comfortable, like, expressing any form of hate now, because I don't hate anyone the way that Kendrick hates Drake.
Sure. Yeah, no, sure.
I'm team Kendrick.
Richard, do you wanna join sides here?
I am team Kendrick.
Okay, good. We've got this settled.
And that's
this is a Kendrick podcast.
Sorry. Like, I mean, that is mostly because there are a lot of different public perception moments from Drake's side that mm-hmm. you see, and it's just like, that's not cool. You should probably not, you know.
Was he the guy that was friends with Justin? No, that was Usher.
He did do music with Justin Bieber.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if that's good or bad. I remembered that cultural artifact from the back of my head somewhere.
Hilariously, in one of the diss tracks, Drake calls out Kendrick for doing a song with Taylor Swift when...
Wait, why?
When,
Don't answer that question.
It's a way to get.
I like her music. Yeah. No, who doesn't like Taylor Swift? I think her music's good. There's my opinion. Hot take.
anyway, but hilariously, Drake did a promo for that song that Kendrick featured on. And Drake did a feature for Justin Bieber. So it's like, how are you going to call out him for helping out the Swifties and, you know, working with Taylor Swift when you promoted the song and worked with Bieber?
I wish.
And this isn't like post like 2015 Bieber when like his music actually started to develop into like really artistic and interesting stuff. This was like 2012 Bieber when he was still like pushing out
the pop, the bubble pop.
Yeah.
Nick Jr. stuff.
Sure.
I kind of wish there was like, in different, the codex. I wish life had a codex you could just access. It's like, what have I unlocked about rap real quick and hip hop so I can like look this
there
up?
Is,
the like, what's the lore behind this?
There's the subreddit Out of the Loop.
Yeah.
That would help you. Probably help you.
I mean, I'm not going to look into it.
This one will require like, a 10-hour long video essay.
Yeah, there's lots of like connections, and then when you get into people who are like, no, let's break it down line by line, exactly like what this means and why it's important, and so it's
very that is sometimes necessary for some of Kendrick's songs.
Sure, yeah, because he's very very
Pulitzer
good,
Prize
good
winning
with yes,
yeah,
with
yeah,
his lyricism.
That's the reputation that I've even somebody that doesn't know music, that's the reputation that I've always assumed, and I've always assumed. With Drake, it's always been the guy in that funny gif where he's doing that dance, you know?
Yeah.
That's the thing. And him switching basketball teams every 12 seconds. Like, I don't know. He may have only switched once. I don't remember. But, like, those are the things that I associate with him. So I mean, if that's what I associate, then that must be true. Are we ready for video games?
Sure.
Connor, what have you been playing?
I have been playing Dave the Diver a lot.
Hey, okay.
Yes. It is a surprisingly calming game. Like diving into the ocean, getting fish to run your sushi bar sounds like it'd be fairly relaxing. The ambient sounds while you're underwater, super relaxed. Even when you're like in the quote unquote dinner rush and you're running back and forth, grabbing sushi from the bar to bring to patrons, filling up their glasses with green tea and then cleaning up the stations. It's not hectic. It's just calming. If you have PlayStation Plus, it's the free game. Pick it up. It's a good play.
Anything else?
No, not really.
Richie?
I've been playing Stellar Blade.
Oh, hey, that's right.
Yeah. I've been playing Stellar Blade. And I am 100% in love with this game.
Good.
It is kind of surprised. Not surprised. Yes, surprised me. So we played the demo. We talked about it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
We talked about how good it felt. And I'm not sure how long did the demo go for? Do you know?
Hour and a half, okay. Maybe? I don't know.
Well,
I'd guess an hour probably tops.
So I played the first couple nights, and the thing is I play, you know, after hours when the wife is asleep, and so I'm trying to not make any noise. So unfortunately I didn't have certain aspects to the entirety of the game at my disposal. So playing it and going through these linear stages of this very Souls light type of game that focuses more on the action than it does the Souls aspects of it, I really began to enjoy it a lot. And then last night, several things happened. I began to play with the headphones, and I was greeted with some very, very incredible music.
Yeah.
And I knew that it was made by the Nier Automata composer, the same.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think they've done about 40% of the music in this game.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So a lot of it very much has hues of Nier Automata, and there's going to be a lot of comparisons to Nier Automata.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Both, you know,
because you're playing as a sexy lady.
And not just that, but their stories are somewhat similar.
Okay.
Although we have Eve, who of course, marketing wise, has been shoved front and center as, you know, a very beautiful,
sure,
very beautiful woman that you play as, who's very cool. But when you play as her, she's very aloof. And it's mostly just because of the knowledge she doesn't have about the world that you're in. She has emotion. She's not like completely devoid of any of that. But you begin to kind of, there's something up story-wise with her coming down, helping people, and kind of realizing things aren't what she knows them to be. Or and things are in more of dire straits than she probably thinks they are. But as I play more and more, the aesthetic of the game is one of the best futuristic. I don't know if I should call it cyberpunk. Not cyberpunk. It's desolate, you know. But mm-hmm. just the you have characters where a majority of their skull is missing, and it's just mechanical.
Oh,
but they're still like running cool. around. You have somebody who's essentially just this part of their body, and everything else is like kind of centipede-esque.
Oh, so just like you're just a chest connected to like a
they themselves are connected to something body. Else. Yeah,
interesting. And, okay.
And there's just so many cool visual stylings that I very much applaud the artist for the game. I think I'm about 8-9 hours in, and I've already had a blast just kind of exploring everywhere and having these small open areas that I can kind of ask myself, can I get there? And yes, you can. And there may not be anything up there, but you can get there if you try hard enough. And I think that's rewarding in of itself, even if there isn't anything shiny to collect at the end, just because it scratches that itch of the fiddler who wants to just kind of explore things. The denizens of the city that you're at are somewhat interesting, and there's this kind of push and pull of if they like you or if they don't like you, because you yourself are seen as an angel. They call you angel.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But there are those who don't like you because it's become this how some folks view religion. Character of Eve comes from, I believe, what they call the mother sphere. There are a bunch of people who are like, the mother sphere will save us one day from this hellscape that we're at.
Oh, interesting.
But there's other people who are like, yeah, no, we've been living like this for decades. Help's not coming. Like, you can fuck off.
So is Eve, are they returning to Earth? Is that the story? Do you not know yet?
I don't fully know yet.
Oh, because that almost sounds like
yes, they kind of are. They are returning to Earth to help rid the Nativas, that they call them, the creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're coming to like kind of destroy them, but it also seems like that is futile in a lot of ways.
Interesting.
Like, they are sending people, but for some it seems like they're sending them as kind of an act of like, we're trying, you know, but it's you know, useless at the end of the day. So you will encounter people in the city who are like, yeah, oh, you're an angel. Yeah, don't talk to me. Get out of my face.
Okay.
Or there will be some folks who are like, wow, I've never seen an angel before. Like, I didn't know. And some people will ask for your help. And there's a really cool bounty board that you get, and people will, hey, my husband's missing. Can you find him? And like I said, it comes with Eve's, I'll call it ineptitude, but just her not understanding how things work. When you find, like, the husband, he may or may not be, you know, well, he's pretty much dead. But but when you, like, go to return, you have to, like, tell them. But you tell them on, like, a message board. So the way Eve explains it to them, she doesn't know how to put it succinctly. So kind of... She doesn't like, yeah, your husband's dead, you can find me. It's just like, I don't really know how to tell you that, like, I'm sorry. Like,
it's
just
interesting. This, like, okay.
Yeah. Very surprised after however long, 7 to 10 hours in, going through these semi-linear areas, very surprised to learn that the game turns into an open world game.
Okay.
And so when you have to repair your ship after returning from the demo area, go to the wasteland because you're just like, I'm going to do it on foot. It's the wasteland. It's a huge, like, open, like, world area. And you have telephones or fast travels, which are really cool. I do always like that idea of having a pay booth as a fast travel. But I just got to that open world. And so from there, it's like there's these solar towers that help provide power to everything else. And you may not be able to get to a rest point because it needs power to activate the vending machine.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So there's something wrong with the solar tower. At least I did that once. I don't know if I'll have to do it again. But of course, along the way, you'll find new enemies. The enemy design is incredible. Some of the boss fights I've already encountered are really neat. And I think that it strikes such a balance with how much action I want and how much of the like souls like approach I want as well. Because I've talked about it before off the podcast, but kind of like sick of like souls like approaches to things. But it's just enough of it to not make it a souls game.
Okay.
But enough to satiate that need. And I'm also very surprised at, although they do have, some of the characters have very much, Korean game development features. And I know that's a very vague statement, but when you look at a game made from Japan, you can tell it's made from Japan.
Sure.
Korea also have certain aesthetics to their facial features and bodies.
Yeah.
And so one of your partners is a younger girl who's like the techie. She has a very small like head face and like huge eyes.
Okay.
But that's just like the style. Despite how some of that looks, strangely enough, I've seen some cutscenes where like the focus isn't on their hands, but their hands will be by their face, or you'll get some facial the light will hit their face just right, that it's more detailed than you expect. So it kind of surprises me. All in all, I'm extremely, extremely happy with the game, and I think it's something that's kind of like pulling me out of like need a video game to play, and it's like like this is it. So I'm excited to get more into it and then find out more of the story, because I don't know if Eve is a robot or not. There hasn't been like a specific statement of like, yeah, she's a robot or anything, but I know that she wears like a spinal
thing, okay,
like a body core, they call it, but it's like a supplemental thing.
Gotcha. So there is like a new emerging, I think it's probably emerging, Souls subgenre, which is sort of the open world Souls-like, where you still have that Souls-like structure where certain enemies will respawn if you get hit the bonfires and whatnot. Rise of the Ronin is like this. Jedi Survivor was like that.
Yeah.
You're in the combat is Souls. The combat itself is very Souls-like, but the structure and the pacing to it is different because it's not that linear death, repeat, death, repeat, death, repeat that you got in the Dark Souls games. Obviously, Elden Ring is more on the hardcore Dark Souls side because you spawn at specific places and so many enemies respawn and the combat's harder. So that's interesting. Yeah, and I actually really like that structure. Yeah. Since I played it with, I really liked it in Jedi Survivor. I really liked it in Rise of the Ronin. So it strikes a nice balance between the repetitiveness, the difficult repetitiveness of a Souls-like, and more of the more relaxed open world action game, yeah, a la Witcher or something like that.
Yeah, and that is something that I have no idea why I didn't click with me, but yeah, it's Jedi Survivor.
Is it pretty similar?
Very close to Jedi Survivor in terms of how everything operates. Yeah, you, instead of gaining, like in Souls games, instead of gaining a thing from killing an enemy that you level up, just kind of level up innately, spend those points to do it.
Oh, okay.
At any point in time. Well, no, not any point. You still have to get to a place, but
to a vending machine.
Yeah, and then yeah, when you do rest, enemies come back. But if you've done it once to get there, you can do it again. You know, it's not as hard going back as it is going forward. So
okay, so I have finished Pacific Drive. If you're watching this, I actually have it on the table right here because somebody's going to borrow it.
Shiny.
No, but I finished Pacific Drive. After finishing it, I came away and it was fun, but it did tend to wear thin toward the end. And I think it's an idea that needs a sequel, that needs solutions to certain problems, because Pacific Drive takes a lot of different things. It takes your car management games. It takes your, you know, what's the book that inspired the Stalker series and inspired the Stalker movie? Picnic, Roadside Picnic. It takes that Roadside Picnic zone concept and does some interesting things with it. And it takes roguelike elements and does some interesting things with it. But so some of the things I didn't like about Pacific Drive is I didn't think it had good risk reward systems in it. So when you go out and run in Pacific Drive, you have to drive into the zone. You got to get resources. There's objectives you may have to complete going somewhere, whatever. And the way it works is when you go to you drive down a highway and then you get into these open maps, which are always randomized. That's actually really neat about the game. I think when I look back playing the game, I think I only remember a map repeating like a handful of times. Other than that, I was constantly driving on new maps with new roadways and stuff like that. But the way it works is you go to an area of the map. This area of the map, you have to get these cores that unlock a gate that sends you back to the garage, right? When you open this gate, all hell breaks loose. A storm comes in. If you get caught in the storm, it damages your vehicle to hell. It can kill you. So you have to drive to this gate to escape. And then you're back in the garage. The garage is a safe area. That's where you can upgrade. That's where you can store and organize all your resources and stuff like that. And a lot of other stuff happens there. And then when you go on your next drive, the zone that you went to, that you opened the gate in, now has a road that's connected to it. So you don't have to open the gate in that zone. You can drive through it and exit it without having to find those cores. And then you get to a new zone. And in that next zone, you have to open the gate. So that's how you open paths and stuff like that. So the danger of going into new zones is you have to get these cores, put them in your car. And then when you're ready, activate a gate. And it's a race against the clock to get there before the storm catches up with you. But I don't think, I didn't really feel like a risk reward. And what I mean by that is, like, there are things where, I don't know, it's like, how far do I want to go to try and get more resources? If I see on my map that there's buildings on the other side of the map that may be worth exploring, getting over there takes time. And no matter what you do in the zone, you're going to take damage because you're going to run into stuff. There's anomalies that are going to damage your car. Some anomalies spring into existence. There's these things called green ash, I think it is, or something. But anyway, it does a lot of radiation and they appear out of nowhere. And then it's kind of creepy. It like slowly builds out from the ground and you can watch it. And when you're in it, it damages your car. So your car is going to get damaged and busted up and you have to repair it. So the more stuff you do in the zone, the more likely you are that your car is going to get damaged, which means the more likely you're going to have to spend resources to repair it. But so it was like, oftentimes, instead of stopping in zones and exploring it thoroughly, I would drive through them a lot because it just wasn't worth taking the chance to damage my car because the resources to build the repair material are not... they're not rare, but they're not everywhere either. So there were times where I had no repair material and I had to go out and find it. Another example is tires. So in the game, tires will get flattened. If they hit a spike or something, they'll pop and they'll be useless because they've just ruptured because you've used them too long. They'll go flat, not flat. They'll lose traction because they've just become worn out. So you have to crap, and some of those you can't repair. Like if you get a flat tire, you can repair it, your tire's fine. If your tire blows out, it's destroyed. You have to craft a new tire and replace it, right? So tires have to be constantly managed. There is a puncture proof tire in the game that I eventually unlocked and equipped to my car, and that basically fixed all those problems because now my tire wasn't going to pop and stuff like that, so I didn't have to worry about that. And that instantly made for me, it was like, okay, well, why deal with tires popping all the time? The benefits of having different types of tires give you different traction. So like off-road tires give you better traction if you're driving through the woods or something off the road. But the benefits of those other tires provide just do not, in my opinion, cancel out how often you have to fix them. And when you fix them, it takes resources because In order to fix a flat tire, you have to have a thing called a sealing kit, and you have to build those, which takes resources. And as soon as you use it, it goes away. So every time you have to repair a flat tire, you have to build a new sealing kit or use a sealing kit. So it's like, it's not worth using. You're constantly having to use resources to upgrade, to upkeep your car. And so I switched to these puncture-proof tires, and it was fine. And so it was like, instead of me making a tactical choice, which tire do I want to do for what purpose, I just picked the easiest one because I got tired of fixing, right? And I would have rather had the off-road tires, but they were just too much of a hassle. So it's like balancing little things like that. There was tools will break down and you have to rebuild tools, just like in a lot of survival games. But there was a time where I needed to build a tool and I needed one resource and I couldn't find this. And it was a really basic tool, a hammer that breaks open different things, like locked doors and stuff like that. And so I had to drive for like an hour. I have like 2 hours of gameplay where I didn't have this basic tool because I just wasn't finding the one resource that I needed to unlock it, you know, or to rebuild it, which is like really annoying. So, yeah, you know, there's not a lot of reason to risk things. There's not a lot of, you know, in different roguelites, it's like, I'll spend this run just doing this one thing, and I know I'll die at the end, but that's okay, because I'm just going to get experience or whatever. There's really nothing like that in Pacific Drive. So towards the end of the game, you're just doing a lot of avoiding stuff, just trying to get to the next thing so you can progress the story forward. It's a really fun game. The ambience is amazing because it's this creepy zone with all these like different sounds and strange sights and stuff like that. I wish somehow they made the car and some of the mechanics behind maintaining it a little more user friendly. Like maybe if I didn't have to. If when I fixed a flat tire, I could just get out and fix it real quick and it would be fine instead of me having to build something to fix it and then constantly having to rebuild those every time I used it up, something like that. So, yeah, I would still recommend it if you're into it because it is pretty unique in a lot of ways. And it does tell an interesting story. But I think it's a game that definitely like needs a sequel. It needs to be built on top of and improved upon in some ways. I'm not clever enough right now to like think of how specifically it should do that.
Add microtransactions.
Definitely not that.
Season pass.
But live service where there's multiple cars. It's a looter shooter now. No. But it is I'm glad I was excited for it, been excited for it a while. Glad I finished it. Just at the end it was like I got tired of fixing things. I just wanted to be able to drive and progress to the next part of the story, which isn't always readily available.
Now, when you say you're tired of it, is that a pun? You said it a lot. So,
and then I wanted to say one more thing about another game. I made a mistake, guys.
Oh no! Oh no!
Baldur's Gate 3 came calling.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to talk about Vampire Survivors. But
no. So I started my second playthrough of Baldur's Gate 3. This is a good time to do Baldur's Gate 3 because the game is now fixed. when it released, it probably could have used another few months, but we don't talk about that because it's the greatest game ever made.
No one does, yeah.
But probably could have used a few more months. I had some real crazy bugs that I faced when I played through the game, but the game was so detailed and amazing that I kind of fought through a lot of it. But it definitely felt like my first playthrough was sort of a early access playthrough. This playthrough, I can already tell things are smoother, things look better, a lot of weird miscellaneous stuff that I came across hasn't cropped up yet, so I don't think it's there. I'm also doing a Dark Urge playthrough. So, Richard, I'm not sure if you're familiar with what Dark Urge is.
I'm not.
So, when you make a character in Baldur's Gate 3, you can play as the origin characters, which are your companions that you meet, like Asterion, Karlach, Will, all them. And they have their own, they have voice acting, they're full-fledged characters. Yeah. They have voice acting, they have their own quests, all that, right? Now, sure. You can play as them as you want. And this is the same thing for Divinity as well. You could play as the origin characters. You can also make a character. And then your character, the character that you make isn't voiced. They have voice lines, but they're like the dialogue isn't voiced. And then you can pick the Dark Urge, which is a character that you create, but you have this, a dark urge to murder things. And you don't know where it came from. Okay. You don't know what's up. All you know is you don't know who you are. You, you don't know how you got there. All you know is you must kill. It is literally that.
So the character you created
has this like deeper, instead of just being one of the characters that is infected with a tadpole, which happens at the very beginning, you're infected with a tadpole and you have this other side story, much like the rest of the characters. You could kill the tadpole. You can't actually, but you can try.
Lobotomize yourself.
Yeah.
Jump off a cliff. Problem solved.
Being a Sigma.
But I'm playing as a monk. I was interested in playing as a monk because they have hand-to-hand fighting skills, and apparently, if you build them certain ways, they can be.
Monks are very OP.
Super powerful. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I will report more on that later.
If you don't want to get hit, be a monk.
Okay, are we ready to hit that news? Yeah. Let's do it. Thanks for listening. If you like our content, please consider subscribing or leaving a like and comment. You can find us at patreon.com/thegamingdiscourse. And our tiers are $2, $4, $7, and $10 and include getting your name in the video credits, early access, and access to our Discord server.
Taylor Joy wore at the Furiosa premiere.
Oh, was it?
I'll pull it back up. Anyways, go ahead.
Wave for babies. Connor,
yes.
What the hell is going on with Helldivers 2?
Let me tell you about Helldivers 2.
Yeah.
Specifically about Helldivers 2 about to require a PSN account.
It was.
It was. An update.
Things are fine now.
Yeah.
We're all fine. We're all fine here now.
How are you? First announced in a Steam post, Helldivers 2 PC players would require linking their Steam account to a PSN account. This would begin today, May 6th, but it was intended to be in place from the beginning, but Helldivers 2 server problems at launch delayed it. Players, understandably, got angry and started leaving poor reviews in droves.
Yeah.
Among the fallout, Steam began refunding Helldivers 2, or began refunds, and Helldivers 2 was pulled from sale in 177 countries where the PlayStation Network is not available. But last night, Sony reversed course, saying in a tweet, quote, "Helldivers fans, we've heard your feedback on Helldivers 2 account linking up on the account Helldivers 2 account linking update. The May 6th update, which would have you required Steam and PlayStation Network account linking for new players and for current players beginning May 30th, will not be moving forward. We're still learning what is best for PC players, and your feedback has been invaluable. Thanks again for your continued support of Helldivers 2. Keep you updated on future plans."
What did we think about this? What did we? What was our? Because this happened real quick. It happened over the weekend. Mm-hmm. This is basically the biggest story of the last week. But I think this is interesting for a few different reasons. But yeah, what do you guys think?
I'm more superficial, like knee-jerk stuff. I didn't think too much of it, like, the first time around. Actually, the first day and a half.
Until people started getting banned because they started making PSN accounts with VPNs because they didn't have PlayStation Network in their country.
I didn't know that.
Yes. People are using VPNs to create accounts.
I didn't know that. I saw some other supposed folks from other countries just be like, "Yeah, I just made one."
Really?
Like, it was fine. Yeah, I just made it, but I didn't hear about that. No. Yeah, when they took away when they prevented people who bought the game from playing it, and then of course pulling it from those 177 countries. That's when it was just like, "Oh, this is a bigger issue than it should be." First off, but yeah, it's bigger in the scope of things, and that's when things started to look more at this. Because I just kind of like, "Oh, it's not a big deal. It doesn't affect me, so why should I be?" You know,
I didn't like it when I saw it. I think this is one of those things where it's not about the specific situation, it's about the systemic situation. Mm-hmm. Because it's just, when it comes to PC, if you've played on PC long enough, you're so used to a relatively open ecosystem, in a sense, It's sort of like the difference, really, but the difference between like consoles and PCs is how much more open the ecosystem is. In some respects, you still have to bow to either Steam or now Epic. But I think Steam has been a relatively good shepherd for PC gaming. And I don't know if you could say the same about like Xbox and PlayStation, but yeah, when it comes to this, I think it puts a bad taste in my mouth because I don't know if it was really necessary. It's clearly easy to make a PSN account, but again, it's like, does that need to happen? It's easy to make an Epic account. It's easy to, I don't know, to link accounts. Whatever. It's easy to sign into my Microsoft account when I launch the Master Chief Collection. Mm-hmm. But do games need to be that complicated? Do we need to have multiple sign-ins and stuff like that? And so that's the thing that I think that to me that was the larger issue is it was not. This is not the first time this has happened. It's not the last time. But it's another marble in a giant pit of marbles that is all about barriers to play. It's all about games becoming harder or more user unfriendly to play based on nothing, but I really think corporate shenanigans. I don't know if PlayStation initially said this was a moderation thing, knowing what PlayStation has said in the past.
Well, they're doing it for the kids.
Our boy Jim Ryan, yeah, you know, once saying that they didn't have, you know,
for the children.
Sony once said that they weren't going to do cross platform because they had children to think about. So it's like, how can you believe a lot of their reasons for their decision making? I don't know. I think it's mostly mercenary. This is useless speculation, but my speculation was that it probably has to do something with metrics.
Yeah,
because PlayStation is trying to make this push into mobile and live service. Mm-hmm. I think that's a stupid decision. Richard, we filmed Coffee and Pie yesterday.
Yeah, don't tell them.
Which hopefully will come out soon. But we, no rush, sorry.
Oh, fuck. You're fine. You're on the timeline now.
Come out this week. No. But anyway, we had this discussion yesterday about by 2030, Sony is going to be, we joked, Sony's going to be in crisis mode and executing employees while Xbox is going to be back at the top of the mountain, right? And it's just going to flip, just like it did with PS3, 360, just like it did with Xbox One, PS4. It seems like whenever one of these companies gets a leg up, they do something completely fucking stupid, and the other company is there to welcome everybody in arms or somehow win the next 10 years. So PlayStation is trying to react to Xbox's like platform agnostic approach now, and one way that they're doing it, it may not necessarily be directly because of it, but one way that they're doing it is, you know, bolstering live service and mobile, which is not their strength for the past 10 years. Their strength was every year they had a first party,
a banger
game that sold a lot, sold consoles.
That was,
and then they found success on the secondary market in PC, right?
Oh yeah.
So that's their strength. Now they're doing this. Get back to Helldivers 2. I think my speculation was maybe this was a metrics thing because they don't own Arrowhead. Can they claim during quarterly reports when they want to show, hey, look at our monthly active users, people spending time on our services. Can you claim that in a quarterly report when it's from a studio that you don't own, you just publish their game, you know? And when people are, you know, sure, the PlayStation logo appears before Helldivers, but when people buy stuff on Steam, that money is getting split between Arrowhead, Steam, and PlayStation somehow, I assume. So if you were to consolidate that and through a PSN account or something like that, could you add those metrics to your quarterly report? So you could report those as, here's the numbers that we have on our PlayStation services, so that some moron shareholder somewhere could be like, oh, look at that, you're growing, or something dumb, right?
Yeah.
So that was my speculation. I have no idea if that's true. But back to the original problem, barriers to play really bother me. In the past couple months, I installed Splinter Cell Conviction on my PC and had to jump through an annoying amount of hoops to get a game that isn't even 10 years old yet. Maybe 10 years old. It may be like 11 years old. It came out like 2011 or 12 or maybe 10. I don't remember.
This is late 2000s.
Was it late 2000s?
Oh, yeah, it was.
Well, the point is...
2010.
Okay. So it's 14 years old. The point is, Should a 14-year-old game be as difficult to play as to set up as it was for me? No, it shouldn't, especially when we're talking about PC.
Well, it was going through Uplay, and Uplay yes, just shouldn't exist.
It was going
exist.
Through Uplay, and I had to jump through hoops to get it fixed, and those hoops shouldn't be there. I remember when I set up Diablo 2 on me and on my wife and I's Switches, and I had to jump through so many hoops to set up like Blizzard accounts and Nintendo Online accounts and to get that all set up, and it just wasn't it wasn't streamlined, and it was something that doesn't need to exist like that. But we have it that way because we have a bunch of corporate hands trying to manipulate things different ways. And that's a sucky for preservation because these because with multiple accounts, with multiple services that juggle all these games, stuff happens over time that makes them more difficult to play. Mm-hmm. So it's just the entire thing just does not need to be there. There needs to be a simpler line of play between player and game that doesn't require so many logins, that doesn't require so many emails, so many accounts. And so I think the frustration emerged from that. And I understand that. I do want to bring up Valve's power here.
So this is actually something that a lot of people don't actually know. When you do the Valve refund system, it's automated. You can request a manual refund, like someone to actually go through and look at the information.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit harder to access.
But people were getting refunds that were way beyond.
And it's because there's like a caveat in like their
sure
agreement that if the game becomes no longer available in your region, which if you're not able to make a PlayStation Network account because PlayStation Network isn't provided in your area,
yeah,
the game was no longer available to you.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because that's Valve. That was Valve's decision, and that was a decision in direct response to one of the big three console console powers, and PlayStation didn't seem like they had anything to do that to react to that, right? So I don't know, because we often talk about Valve being this like the immense power Valve holds is almost people don't realize just the influence and the immense power that holds and the influence Steam has. So when they flex it
and they release their Steam power,
it's like, whoa, you know,
it probably doesn't help Sony that a majority of the Helldivers 2 players are PC as well.
Is that true?
It's like 3-1 or 3-2.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. I didn't know it was that.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Lopsided. Interesting. I don't know. It is curious how this influences their thinking when it comes to PC as well, because if this is such a big hit, do they consider putting games out PC Steam at the same time? But that's been in the discussion since Helldivers first came out, so I don't know if it changes their thinking at all. But yeah, my main point this whole thing is that this kind of stuff to me is less about the individual decision of it happening with Helldivers and more about it's just things like this never make games easier to preserve or play as the years goes on. And games should not be user hostile. There should not be all these barriers and different things you have to do to play a game. So I know I sound like an old man. Pop in a disc and play a game. But like,
well, really? Yeah, it does provide. Like, I mean, that's a huge reason why my stores don't take PC games. It's like one-time use codes, like serial numbers, stuff like that. Compatibility issues is a major thing. It's like, yeah, I'm sorry. Like, I'm not going to have this conversation every single time with somebody of why they can't play their game on their system, especially when PCs are so like on the large spectrum of. What graphics card do you have? What CPU do you have? How much RAM do you have? Et cetera, et cetera.
So. Complete wild list. Is there a big market for collectible?
There would be.
Like box?
Yes, CD? Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, before 2005, you have a big box game, like PC game, shitload of money, man.
So what about like...
Like I remember, this was back in, I don't know how much I'd get for it now, but I sold my wife... Her stepdad let us take all the like PC games that they had in the garage. A lot of them weren't in there, which sucked. But he had something like Ultima 9 Ascension, big box, and it was like this big. You open it up, and it had like a bunch of like, you know, collectible stuff in it. And it's like that alone I sold for like $40 on eBay. And it's like, and it's just stuff. It's not like there wasn't even the game. So if you, you know, and that was a decade ago, well over a decade ago. And so if you have that stuff now, you know, how much would it be? Because it's having that bygone era that nobody was, not many people were into.
Sure.
How many people in the mid 90s, late 90s had PCs capable of like running games? Yeah, not a ton. I mean, you heard about it a lot. You definitely did, but yeah, I didn't have anything like that till the late 2000s.
Yeah, and the Steam came around right with Half-Life 2. So yeah,
ruined everything.
That's right when you started to digital distribution started to go off. So that's right when PC started to drop off.
It was over when my good friend bought Destiny 2 and physically, and it was just a paper disc with the code on it. And it's just like, okay.
For PC?
For PC, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
It's over.
That's why I waited a month to get the physical edition of Pacific Drive, because I'm an old man. Back in my day, you just put the disc in and it played your game.
Now, Richard.
Yes.
I want you just a quick, like, off the top of your head appraisal. I have a copy
I know what game
of the video game tie-in for the smash hit 2007 movie Beowulf.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
How much would I have to pay you to take it?
Like a dollar. Oh, wait. Pay me to take it?
Because I know it's going to buy it.
That's true. Actually, a guy did try to buy a Beowulf on 360 the other day.
It's PC.
Oh, all right. Well, I couldn't find it, so you couldn't buy it anyway.
No. Oh, no.
I did find it today, though, but I couldn't find it at the time. A dollar. Pay me a dollar.
I'm going to walk in and say, hey, I can sell this for, I saw an eBay listing for $40. Will you buy this for $40? And then you're going to look at the eBay listing, and you can tell it's me. Holding it.
Yeah.
So I saw the eBay listing, $10,000. It's just going to be a poor selfie of me holding Beowulf. And you're like, this listing is suspicious.
It is suspicious.
Okay, are we ready to move on?
Myabandonware.com.
That's a good website.
Excellent website.
That is a good website. There are other websites we won't mention, but
they got Dune 2000 on there. Have you ever played Dune 2000? That game is great.
Real quick, I just wanted to circle back to the Helldivers story.
Oh, sure, we can.
Since it's, you know, the topic we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah.
You have the barriers to play issue with it. I have a much more cynical view of it. I saw this really as a Sony saying fuck you to Xbox users.
How so?
Well, because if they're going to start requiring PlayStation Network accounts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah, I get it.
Well, because we haven't... There's no indication that Helldivers 2 is going to be on Xbox, is there?
There's everyone's speculating about
rumors. Yeah, there was a rumor last week that there's pre-discussions of doing it.
Pre-discussions. I love that.
Yeah, oh yeah, I love it. They're thinking about talking to people.
So I know Xbox, it seems like Xbox would be fine with that, right?
Of course they would be.
Because how would you say, we want Game Pass everywhere, but don't sign into PSN on our
phones? You give us Helldivers 2, we'll give you Halo.
That would be weird. It was weird playing Halo 3 on PC. Playing Halo 3 on a PlayStation.
Sacrilege.
It would be really weird.
Cats and dogs.
Mass hysteria. It would be really weird, but I would get over it. I think I've said everything I want to say about this. Richard.
We got more layoff news, unfortunately. First reported by Jason Schreier.
Jason Schreier.
That's for Jason Schreier, like actual news stories, not just, you know.
Oh, okay.
Like, it'll be like big bold letters, like Jason Schreier. That's my cue.
Okay, all right.
I'm doing my job, Richard.
We got bold italics.
We got 42. Feet stepped on over here. Got feet stepped on.
That button is surprisingly soft.
Connor's going to release a rap song. Yo, you pressed my keys. Now I'm going to hit you with my knees. that's the best I can do.
Right. That would hurt, though. Roll 7, the studio who made Roller Dome that came out, I think, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and Intercept Games, the devs behind Kerbal Space Program 2, Both studios are part of Private Division, a label made for publishing mid-sized games. According to GI.biz, GameIndustry.biz, a vast majority of the label's teams in Seattle, New York, Las Vegas, and Munich have been let go. Game Industry reached out to Take-Two for confirmation, and the company said, quote, on April 16th, Take-Two announced a cost reduction program to identify efficiencies across its business and to enhance the company's margin profile. Excuse me. While still investing for growth. As part of these efforts, the company is rationalizing its pipeline and eliminating several projects in development and streamlining its organizational structure, which will eliminate headcount and reduce for future hiring needs. The company is not providing additional details on this program, end quote.
Yeah, whatever. I'm just frustrated because... is this an economic necessity? You know, cutting costs... Do you really need to do this? Do you really need to put people, you know, up in their lives, get rid of their jobs, close studios and stuff like that to make this work? In a year, you're going to have a game that's going to sell and you're going to have a ton of money. But even before then, it's just like, I don't know. Is this an economic reality or is this an economic nicety? And I think that I'm going to go ahead and speculate that it's a nicety. I don't know how much Strauss Zelnick makes, but he makes way too much. I hate to be the morning talk show host that says he could be a better GM of the Royals than the GM of the Royals, but come on, let's be honest here.
The Kansas City Royals?
Yeah, we could all be the CEO of Take-Two. It's not that difficult.
Yes.
Make sure old Gearbox isn't there anymore, but make sure you're exploiting people in NBA 2K. Make sure Rockstar is okay. Make sure, you know, 12-year-olds are buying fake money in GTA Online. And you basically have your job set.
Baby, you got yourself a stew going.
way too much money on a man that does absolutely nothing and has mismanaged a big company. I don't know. It's frustrating that the industry is in this state when the state has been one that I think has been largely avoidable. And we've talked about that with the pandemic bubble and stuff like that. It's frustrating that all this excitement over GTA is not because GTA 6 Online. It is because of GTA's single player. People were excited for the trailer because it was these two characters. It looked like a Bonnie and Clyde type story, something like that. So everybody was excited for that. I don't think a big percentage of it at all was excited because how is this going to change the broken online features? I don't think anyone was excited about that, and it frustrates me that nobody in the company at the executive level seems to realize that or take that into account when it comes to their decision making. But, you know, people are losing jobs and it's just stupid. And these are, I don't know, these are studios that, like, the other thing is we talk about sustainability. We talk about make smaller studios, smaller games, more sustainable economics, but instead you're cutting those. And I don't even want to know what the budget for GTA 6 is. Whatever it is, it's probably way too much. Whatever it is, it's probably way too much. And that frustrates me. It's way too much. It's way too much for what it needs to be. And so it's like the thing that is more sustainable, you're cutting. And the thing that is unsustainable, it's a locomotive going downhill.
You're going to run out of money before you make money on the thing that you're making.
So it's just like, and that's frustrating.
I think one important thing about GTA 6 that the world needs to know is, will horse testicles shrink in cold air?
Are there horses in Miami? I don't know. Is that
I'm sure there are.
There's got to be.
Last time I talked with horses, they didn't seem like they were.
I got the horses in the back.
I got to see a guy about a horse later. I don't know. Sorry. Are we ready for? Do you have tidbits?
I got tidbits. Yeah,
okay. Do we want to dunk on Strauss Zelnick?
I got tidbits and Circana.
I'll say this. The dumbest name of a CEO, Strauss Zelnick. I don't know why.
I don't know.
I just wanted to dunk on him a little bit.
Okay.
Yves Chamolt's pretty bad.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, we need to add people that we dislike on this show.
Their shit list.
There's Angel Hernandez too. MLB umpire.
Oh right, yeah, you talked about him yesterday at length.
Tired of him. Really all MLB umpires. Yeah. But Anyway, for no reason.
Oh, no, it's not working.
There it goes. There you go. And Blake Jorgensen, who's no longer at EA. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Play tidbits.
What if I told you, in this world, there are bits, and there are tids, and Richard is the only man who can put them together into tidbits.
Korea will now focus on cultivating a console game presence for the next 5 years. Last Wednesday, the Culture Ministry unveiled a five-year plan to promote the game industry, the console game industry in Korea. They will expand the country's share in the global console game market by 2028, aiming to reduce its heavy dependence on online and mobile game platforms. The government said it will help local companies cooperate with major global console game companies like Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo to develop blockbuster titles. It also plans to provide support to independent game companies for the development of a wider range of video games.
Good. So are we talking the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea or...
South Korea.
South Korea. Yeah.
Or both. Are they both like joint venturing this? Peace in our time.
You would have the room and then all the developers, and on like the South Korean side, you'd have like all the new mocap stuff. And then, like, as it transitions to the North Korean side, you'd have, like, Max from the 1980s still. And they're working with, like, wireframe graphics. How are we going to make this game? How are we going to put all this shit together? That's cool. And I know in certain countries there are, like, tax breaks. That are, and I think the philosophy behind it has to do with, like, art, like the government subsidizing art and stuff like that, which that'll never happen in America. We gotta drop bombs and shit like that. We can't expand human.
We have to subsidize
creativity.
NATO.
Yeah, we got to subsidize people killing each other in other fucking places. But it's good that other countries do that. That's nice.
I think it's really neat when at least somebody sees the benefit of, like, you know, a piece of media like video games and whatnot. Sure. I know. So SNK is now owned by Saudi Arabia, like
the Savvy Group.
No.
Is it not them?
I think it's just a singular benefactor.
Oh, okay.
Who, like, owns SNK now. Like, a Japanese company. He owns them, or owns the... But anyways, it was really interesting because it came out the other week, basically stated, like, he's trying to bring back SNK to, like, its glory days of, like, the early 90s, the mid-90s of, like, its arcade presence. Seemed really passionate about, like, no, I want to make them a household name again. And it's just very interesting that, like, you have someone who probably grew up on their games is now, like, in a position
to,
like, kind of feed that.
That kind of sounds similar to what's the Atari CEO, Wade Rosen?
Yeah,
Wade Rosen?
Him too, yeah.
Kind of seems like Wade Rosen, that...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of corporate in there, but also, like, admiration and understanding of the brand, and wanting more for the company than it just to be a brand.
I've said it before, but ever since he took over, he's been making all the right moves. Sorry. So,
yeah.
Real quick, it is currently owned by the MISC Foundation, which is a nonprofit.
Okay, so interesting. Established but not owned?
No, we're
reading
it's
a Wikipedia
owned.
Page.
No, it's owned by... Oh, CEO is not the crown prince. Founder is the crown.
Okay, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that has any association to the Savvy Group then. But interesting. You know, there's something I've always been curious about Korea, because it's like the country is not very big, and you have all these bands that have like a bunch of people in them. And I'm man enough to admit that I love some BTS songs.
BTS is excellent.
But it's like, wouldn't you run in to like famous people all the time? I've always been curious.
About,
it'd be like walking around
those,
LA all the time.
Yeah, a lot of
it's
those.
It's bigger than LA, obviously.
A lot of those K-pop stars, when they're done with their tenure in all of these groups, who a large majority of them become somewhat successful, they all turn into actors as well. So it's just kind of like this whole cyclical
thing. We need more
thing,
of that.
So.
We need more. I want more ensembles in the U.S. There's no like bands with like five. I want NSYNC again, but you know, better, I guess.
You should check out BTS.
but I want it in America.
Well,
I want Spike Tan Frosted Tips.
RM is
we're not going to have like really big American boy bands for a great period of time because the guy that was running all of them Ponzi schemes, well, he's dead now, but he was in jail.
Yeah, okay. All right, well.
So we got to find someone who's willing to run those Ponzi schemes.
I have an idea.
There's those one guys from that Disney movie, Turning Red.
Don't know that.
They're pretty good.
I know this one. How about we do a RPG, but it's like a music-based RPG, mm-hmm. and your party is a boy band group. I think this is a good idea.
That is cool. So,
and then every time you fight, it's like Scott Pilgrim versus the World. You're battling other boy bands, and it's always like other bands
that is,
ensembles.
That is cool. It's pretty cool.
I think this is a good idea.
There is a game on 360 and PS3 called Eternal Sonata, and that is a Japanese JRPG where you play as like Chopin and like all these other like classical musicians, like in like this kind of like dream world.
That's fun.
Like that one. That one's fun.
Yeah. I'm sorry for interrupting you.
No, that's okay. We're chatting. We're you know.
I'm trying to think of the name, and I'm trying to make it like goofing. A D&D clone, like boy bands and something.
Boy bands and I don't know. I'm not good at improvisation, so I don't know. What's next?
I felt this was interesting, but the Japanese company Type Moon, who has made a bunch of visual novels, some of them have become extremely popular, like the Fate series. I think the Fate series is from them. But anyways, they have revealed that the English release of Tsukihime will have a censored art book. And I think this is interesting because they made a big deal out of this, but I'll read what's going on. It's getting its first release in the States. It's a very popular visual novel, Tsukihime. It's been around forever. There's a video game based off it called Melty Blood. It's a fighting game. It's very popular. But anyways, the mature visual novel is hailed for its story, but at certain points has portrayals of nudity. The art book itself shows off some of these images. While uncensored in Japan, Type Moon revealed a message to fans regarding the censorship in the art book. They said, quote, "Due to differing platform publishing policies, the art book included in the physical limited edition for PlayStation 4 will be printed with graphic modifications for 2 pages, while the art book for the Nintendo Switch will be printed without modifications. The game will remain unaltered for both PS4 and Switch versions," end quote.
So the art book, a digital art book, I'm assuming.
No, physical art book.
Wait, so that comes with the game?
The game, yeah.
So you can walk into a GameStop, and if there's a PS4 copy next to a Switch copy,
yeah.
and you open up both copies,
mm-hmm.
it's the same book, but because one came with a blue box, it's censored?
Well, Sony, several years ago, I think it was when Jim Ryan took over.
Thinking about the children.
Like, hardcore censorship laws, like, or censorship policies hit Sony.
I did not know
this. So a lot of like anime series on the PlayStation 4 like became like heavily censored or like restricted in some way.
Reason to be annoyed with Jim Ryan.
one of the biggest of which was the Senran Kagura games. Bunch of them, very fan servicey. But it's funny because Nintendo, on the other hand. Yeah, whatever, guys. Come on in.
You would think
there are literal hentai games on like the Switch, and it's just like whatever. Come on.
Yeah. So much for freedom of expression in the United States. Mm-hmm. Unless you're Nintendo, apparently, then it's anything goes, baby. All right. What's next?
You know, I learned something cool about what the Xbox can do. Like the Xbox One. No, the Xbox. Sorry, the Xbox One, the Series, the.
Okay.
You can download a digital version of the game. And just use the disc to play it.
Oh, yeah. The 360. Wait, hold on. How do you mean?
Let's say if you were out and about, found a scratched up copy of Cyberpunk 2077.
Okay.
That wouldn't install on your system. It reads, but it doesn't install because it's like scratched up. You can, on your phone, go to the Xbox app, find the game in the Xbox app, and then just hit download the console, and it'll download the game, the full game, to your system, but you won't be able to play it without the disc verifying.
Oh, interesting. So you can download copies that aren't, like, authenticated or whatever?
Yeah.
But it's on your hard drive.
But as soon as you put the disc in, it'll be like, oh, cool, you own it, and it'll play it.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know you could do that either.
Yeah.
Now, I remember with the Xbox 360, you can install games on your hard drive from the disc.
Right.
and then it would run faster. And I remember
we
did that with Battlefield Bad Company too, because you would load into levels like a solid 5 seconds before everybody else.
I still pray. I wish I had this, but they sent me. That function was screwed up for Halo Reach.
Was it?
Yes. That function was screwed up for Halo Reach, and it caused like actual issues. And they sent something specific to players who like, you know, yeah, I was affected by this, and they I did it, and they sent me basically. It looked like a prototype copy.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, I don't know what I did with it, no. You know, but that would have been cool. Actually, you know, I'm gonna look that up.
I remember I had Halo 4 and I had Halo 4 installed on my Xbox 360 and the disc that I had got scratched, but because I had it installed, it would still read or whatever. So even though the disc wouldn't work, as long as I had it installed, I guess the issue there is if I had to uninstall it, I would have had to go get a new disc somewhere. But still, that was a really neat feature with the 360. Yeah, you know, consoles. The PS5 has been a really good console too. There are some things about it that I wish that are still. I hate that I have to press down, go all the way to the other side to get to the power and sleep button, and I don't care about stories, Sony. Nobody cares. Nobody wants to see stories up there, Sony, when I press the PlayStation button. But considering that, like, I love that I can jump into a save. Oh my God, you know how amazing that is? Especially even if you're switching games. Mm-hmm. I've been switching between Rise of the Ronin and Pacific Drive so much. If you have a saved game or you have a recent autosave, you can put in the other disc, go to the other game, hit resume activity. It loads your most recent save, so you're right back to where you were. Really useful. So like splash screens and wading through all that are a thing of the past, to the point now where when I get into a game that still has splash screens, like on PC, drives me out the wall because I'm like, I don't have the experiences anywhere else and I want to get past it. I understand that you have to put the companies first and whatever, but
please think of the CEOs.
Have you found what you were looking for in life or on your computer?
No-ish.
Okay, the ish has me intrigued though. So
we can move on. I got Circana numbers.
Yay!
From a good friend, Mr. Matt Piscatella.
Friend of the show.
Verbatim
on next week.
Yes, always on next week. We just haven't uploaded the episode. We'll get to it. Projected U.S. spending on video game hardware, content, and accessories gained 4% in March versus year average, reaching $4.9 billion. Mobile content spending grew 15%, offsetting a 32% drop in hardware. Let's see here. Let's take a look at the top 20 games, March 2020.
Of March? Okay.
A little bit of behind, sorry.
That's okay.
How do I approach this? How should I approach this? Oh my God, really? Wow.
Let's see.
What's up?
So, okay, go ahead. Do what you were going to do.
Do we want to go in number one? Do we want to?
Let's do top 10.
All right, top 10. Number 10, we got Hogwarts Legacy.
Still up there.
Yeah, number 9, we got WWE 2K24. Number 8, we have Unicorn Overlord from Sega and VanillaWare. Number 7, we have Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Number 6, we got Princess Peach Showtime. 5, Rise of the Ronin. Number 4 is Modern Warfare 3. I can't believe that game is still selling well. MLB 24 will be number 3. Number 2 is Helldivers 2, and number 1 is Dragon's Dogma 2.
Dragon's Dogma. Uh-huh. I'm curious how Rise of the Ronin has done.
Yeah, I am too, because there has not been much talk on it.
It's a really good game, but it came out same day as Dragon's Dogma, and it was a console exclusive. It was an exclusive on the PS5.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the numbers for that game aren't great. And I wonder if that's not another game that if you throw it onto Steam, it explodes and has a second.
I think the sales are probably fine on it. If it's one thing, it's something I need to keep like telling myself because it's real life and not the internet. But it's if somebody's happy with something, they're not going to talk about it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like you'll get a bad review before you get a good review.
I know
because
what you mean.
People, yeah. You know, and so I think that there are a lot of people who probably bought Rise of Ronin Nobody's talking about it.
Okay. Well,
I think a lot of people are not wanting to give up their stuff now too.
Oh, like physical stuff?
Because I still to this day have not seen a copy of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth come into the store.
Interesting.
But okay. I know that's a big game.
But I also know, isn't there weird stuff going on with Rebirth's performance? There was a story about IGN, I need to read it. Yeah. It was like Rebirth sales are underwhelming, but right. There's more here. I haven't read the story yet.
It is underwhelming from what I understand, but you kind of have to think, you know, exclusive to PS5, $70.
Yeah.
I think there's stuff working against it that's not in its, sure. That's not its fault. Hey, Mario Kart 8 still in the top 20.
Not surprising.
When are they going to release 9?
Yeah, when and never at this point.
Switch 2?
Yeah, Switch 2 probably.
Switch 2. That would be an interesting launch title for Switch 2. Would you do that, though, or would you just...
I think you should.
So what they should do with Switch 2 launch is the next Mario Kart, a Mario Party, like get all like the big bangers out that are going to get groups of people to play it, because, and especially if you have like 8-player eight-player Mario Kart, 8-player Mario Party, then your people are going to be buying multiple consoles or multiple Joy-Cons just to play the game with larger groups.
And then what, the next Zelda is going to be, if it came out 2023, the next Zelda is 2026, 2027?
Probably, yeah. What is it? Mario Kart 8 is a 10-year-old game now.
Mm-hmm.
2013, 2014. Mario Odyssey is 2018. Mario Superstars came out a year and a half ago. They still haven't learned their lesson with both Mario Kart. They haven't learned their lesson with Mario Party and Animal Crossing. That those games, those two specifically, can theoretically last just as long as Mario.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
With supplemental, you know, new maps, new characters, Animal Crossing, put anything that's everything in that game,
mm-hmm.
you know, as packs every quarter, you know.
Sure.
Spring, yeah. Fall, Easter egg summer. Doom
guy. Yeah. I'm not against the idea of expansion packs when well done. Yeah. I think I love the idea of that, yeah.
Yeah, Nintendo is more likely to do those than anything else. What was it? Let's get mobile. Who cares? Dragon's Dogma 2 debuted as the best-selling premium game of March and the third best-selling game of 2024 year-to-date. With just 1 month in the market, Dragon's Dogma 2 has already surpassed the life-to-date tracked dollar sales of Dragon's Dogma and Dragon's Dogma Dark Arisen combined. That's impressive. Helldivers 2 remains the best-selling premium game of 2024 after placing second in March. Helldivers 2 currently ranks 7th in lifetime U.S. dollar sales for Sony published titles after just 2 months in the market. That's very good, especially for $40 game.
Yep.
February video game hardware spending fell 32% when compared to a year ago to $391 million. PlayStation 5, Xbox Series, and Switch spending each declined a minimum of 30% year on year. Hardware spending finished the first quarter down 24% versus the first quarter of 23. PS5 led to hardware market sales, units and dollars, of course. Switch finished second. And of course, Xbox finished like 40 something. third, of course, but ranked second in dollars.
That's like that saying Xbox finished fourth in a three console market. That's like that joke people make when they're picking NFL games for the week. They're like, I'll take the Giants over the Cowboys. I'll take the Rams over the Cardinals, and I'll take the bye week over the Browns. Something like that. Yeah. It's like that kind of joke. Poor Xbox. Poor Xbox.
March spending on accessories increased 9% when compared to a year ago, helped by 8% growth in headset and headphone spending. Of course, the DualSense Edge is the best-selling accessory of March.
Have you ever... played with a DualSense?
It did. Yeah, one did come in, and I felt it.
Was it?
I don't know. No. I don't. I'm old man. If you're not good enough to play with the original controller, you fucking suck. Get out of here. Like, why Jeez. Do you need? Why you need all this Jeez. Other shit to play? But also, I can't speak because I'm not good. So it's like,
yeah.
But also, sure. It's just like, why do you need something that has all this other it stuff gribbles. To give you an edge?
It. I've always wanted a controller like that for Elite Dangerous because I.
Okay.
That makes sense.
That's the only game.
Just get a. You know, just
if you
simulate a cockpit. Just build your own cockpit.
Just build an entire cockpit, yeah. But that's the thing is, like, once you... There's not very many games out there that require that would solve, you know? It's like... And really, keyboard, mouse, and controller all at the same time is fine for Elite Dangerous. But that's more of like a multiplayer type thing.
Yeah, the Steel Battalion sound.
Oh, the Steel Battalion sound. Man, I remember that. Yeah. Wasn't there a press image of like, there's like a nerd holding it with two girls in bikinis next to him? And this is what it's going to be like when you've got the Steel Battalion controller. Yeah. video games used to be marketed so differently. Well, kind of. Not really.
Oh, somebody said on Twitter there, like, I need them to make a Mad Men show, but like based on 90s like video game advertising.
Oh my god, that's a good idea.
And I was like, yeah, that'd actually be a great idea.
Every episode would be the exact same thing. What's the
Mega Man?
Okay. That's excellent, actually.
And it Hollywood, be, you can call me at any time.
It should be John Hamm. It should be John Hamm, and then you have like a bunch of
as Don Draper, but like in his 80s.
But no. You have John Hamm, and in the Don show, Draper, everybody else is like nerds with ponytails, right? So I don't know who's a guy. Get what's that?
TJ Miller.
Get TJ Miller in there, as long as he doesn't do bomb threats or whatever. Get who was that guy that was in the live action Beauty and the Beast? He's Josh Gad. Get Josh Gad in there. Gad, yeah. You know, get Horatio Sands, ponytails on all of them, 5 o'clock shadow. And then you have just the Adonis John Hamm in a suit. Just that juxtaposition to be perfect. We need to pitch this show to someone. Maybe to Netflix. They take shows all the time now, so.
You said Mega Man, and it reminds me, I need to tell somebody about this, but I keep forgetting because I grew up with the video and I loved it. But Missy Elliott had a video for her song Sock It to Me, and it's like she's wearing a Mega Man outfit, and like Lil Kim is wearing like a Proto Man outfit.
Yeah.
And, like, Timbaland is like Dr. Wily, and like it's really cool. It's really funny. It's all shot in fisheye lens, too. So it's really awesome.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it. That's all.
Follow us on YouTube. Go to youtube.com, patreon.com. Check out the interview with Dr. Tanya Pettiford-Waits, and we'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.